I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
U.S. troops in Iraq attacked a mosque complex in the holy city of Karbala last night in an effort to flush out members of the Mahdi Brigade, fighters who were allied with the rebel Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. An arms cache ignited during that battle, setting off a series of explosions that rocked the area for over 2 hours. But even as U.S. forces are moving in on the cleric's fighters, negotiations for a peaceful outcome continue. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Jim Acosta, correspondent for CBS News. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
Jim, what's the latest you're hearing about this fighting between Sadr's Mahdi Brigade and U.S. forces?
Well, from what we understand, the fighting may still be going on. It was happening as late as noon Baghdad time. And as you mentioned, yes, there was some heavy fighting around a mosque in Karbala, and there seems to be some pains that are being taken by American forces to avoid damaging any holy shrines or religious structures. But as we know from watching this so far from a distance, the Mahdi militia and Muqtada al-Sadr's fighters have been using religious sites, using these mosques as gathering places, sometimes as weapon caches.
There also appears to be a lot of negotiating going on at the same time that the fighting is continuing. What's your take on that? I mean, is Sadr trying to establish the best possible position for himself before agreeing to a ceasefire?
Well, that seems to be the case. As we know, he's wanted for a murder that happened here in Iraq, and at this point, what seems to be happening behind the scenes is some kind of negotiation that would perhaps push back any sort of trial date for al-Sadr. It's unclear whether the coalition will go along with this. At this point, all they're really saying, and it's a vague sort of message that they're putting out, and strategically so, is that they're willing to find a peaceful resolution to all of this. It does look like al-Sadr is positioning himself, but at the same time, he's using very heated rhetoric. Today, he spoke to his followers and compared what's happening in Iraq to Vietnam. So he is still urging his fighters with some very superheated rhetoric.
At the same time, and in the bigger picture, there seems to be some evidence that some of his fellow Shia Muslims are getting tired of him and want him to leave Najaf. And in fact, there are hit squads, we're told, the Al-Thulfikar, who are killing some of these Mahdi army members, dropping threatening leaflets. What's that about?
Well, I think it's a sign that some of the Shiites in the south are not going to take this lying down. That there are many Shiites who are willing to, if it's necessary, to take the fight to al-Sadr. We also have heard, just as late as today, that there are some Iraqi military forces that are working under the guise of the coalition that have been clashing with al-Sadr's fighters in the south. That's very preliminary, sketchy information, so we'll have to see how that turns out. But it's a sign that Iraqis are starting to take care of their own affairs, which couldn't please the coalition anymore.
Jim, thank you.
Hope I help. Thanks very much for having me. Appreciate it.
Jim Acosta is a correspondent for CBS News. He spoke with us from Baghdad.
The video showing young American contractor Nick Berg being beheaded by al-Qaeda operatives is horrifying, but it's also fueling a backlash against criticism of abuse by U.S. soldiers. The Islamic militants claim that Berg's death is in retaliation for the abuse of Iraqi detainees at Abu Ghraib prison, seen around the world in recently released photos. Many Americans worried that the release of the photos might provoke retaliation. Others said the scandal at Abu Ghraib prison had been overblown, that the prisoners don't deserve this kind of media coverage. A view expressed yesterday by Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma at the Armed Services Committee hearing.
I have to say, and I'm probably not the only one up at this table that is more outraged by the outrage than we are by the treatment. The idea that these prisoners, you know, they're not there for traffic violations. If they're in cell block 1A or 1B, these prisoners, they're murderers, they're terrorists, they're insurgents. Many of them probably have American blood on their hands. And here we're so concerned about the treatment of those individuals.
Maura Reynolds writes about the backlash in today's LA Times. She joins us from Washington. Maura, outraged by the outrage, someone finally formalized that statement that we feel we've been hearing. Is that what you've been hearing?
Yeah, it's been sort of an undercurrent for a number of days, largely among Republicans, but on both sides of the aisle.
Well, in fact, you write in your article about three overarching reasons for the backlash that you've found. Tell us about them.
Well, the first one is the sense that although the degradation of these prisoners was inexcusable, that in effect it's nothing compared to thousands of murders that were perpetrated under Saddam Hussein's regime. The other thing that people who hold this view say is that it's being unfairly exploited by Democrats, including the Kerry campaign and by the media. And then the last reason is that they really suspect that many of these people were not innocent victims. Inhofe made the argument that the cell block in which this abuse took place was the one that was set aside for the most dangerous detainees. Now, human rights groups say that many, many innocent Iraqis, and probably a majority of those in Abu Ghraib, were in fact innocent. But his point is that the Iraqi detainees in this block were probably not innocent, and therefore we should be somehow less concerned about their treatment.
He also said, I'm also so outraged that we have so many humanitarian do-gooders crawling all over these prisons looking for problems now. I'm wondering, Maura, what's your sense? Words like this, when these pictures first came out, would have seemed impossible and impolitic. Do you have any sense that perhaps Senator Inhofe was in some way given the green light to say them now?
Well, like I said, I think that it's more that there's been a strain of thinking about this. The administration, remember, has really played up the abuses that took place under Saddam Hussein. That has become their major rationale for why we went to war against Iraq and why we are conducting the occupation. The treatment by U.S. soldiers of the Iraqi detainees calls into question how morally superior we are. That's why I think you're seeing this beginning backlash now by people who are saying, wait, 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 but we are morally superior and we do want to bring democracy, and this was an isolated event.
We've been hearing words like this from, let's say, Rush Limbaugh, but are there any other politicians besides Mr. Inhofe saying them?
Oh, well, there were a number of his colleagues on the Armed Services Committee yesterday echoed his remarks after he sort of launched the subject. And I made some phone calls to others on the Hill and heard a very similar reaction. Congressmen said that, you know, what they're hearing from their constituents is that they do feel like some of the outrage has been a little excessive in light of torture by Saddam Hussein. And when you see the kind of brutality on this video that was released, it's very hard for many people to say that what we did was significantly worse.
And how have others responded to it?
Well, I think that the predominant view on the committee and in Congress certainly is that what was perpetrated in Abu Ghraib was inexcusable, regardless of the other things that may have taken place under Saddam Hussein. And they intend to investigate this thoroughly and bring people to justice.
The U.S. Should be held to a higher standard.
Exactly.
Yeah. Maura, thank you.
No problem.
Maura Reynolds reports for the L.A. Times.
As bizarre as it may seem, experts say that torturers often think they are on the moral high ground because they believe they're doing what's right, something that's good for society. Here's what Lindy England, one of the soldiers implicated in the abuse scandal at Abu Ghraib, had to say yesterday in her first interview with KCNC-TV in Denver.
To us, we were doing our job, which meant we were doing what we were told, and the outcome was what they wanted. They'd come back and they'd look at the pictures and they'd state, well, that's a good tactic, keep it up.
Whether they were ordered to or not, why did England and her fellow soldiers do what we saw in the photographs? For some answers, we turn to Dr. Gerald Post, who teaches political psychology at George Washington University. Welcome, Dr. Post.
I'm glad to be with you.
Let's start with some of the guidelines on interrogation that are part of a soldier's training. Now, some of these might seem pretty obvious, but I wonder if you'd give us a few examples of what is not acceptable.
Well, the guidelines are reasonably clear. What also seems reasonably clear, however, is that the guidelines had not been part of the explicit training of the reservists who were in this role. Soldiers may not use mental torture, such as mock executions, abnormal sleep deprivation, or chemically induced psychosis. But just to focus on that phrase, abnormal sleep deprivation, that's really got a lot of grayness built in. There's two sentences in the guidelines which clearly weren't conveyed to them and which I think we would all agree with retrospect were not adhered to. To determine if a contemplated action, approach, or technique would be unlawful, soldiers ask themselves two questions. Would a reasonable person being interrogated feel their rights are violated if they refuse to cooperate? If the contemplated action were perpetrated against U.S. prisoners of war, would I think such actions violate international U.S. law? And I think we can easily say the answer to not just either of those questions, but both those questions would be yes.
But as you say, these soldiers in Abu Ghraib didn't even know these guidelines existed, didn't get this kind of training, which...
Moreover, to take it a step further, it would seem that they were being supported and indeed confirmed for helping prepare the prisoners for interrogation. One of the defendants has indicated he was told he'd done an excellent job. So what was orders, what was an implicit expectation, what was an explicit expectation is quite central.
So is it your sense then that these soldiers probably felt that they were doing their duty, that the pictures were to prove it?
Yeah, and there's almost a sense, without overreading the pictures, of pride, and they certainly seem quite open in the pictures. It isn't that they're skulking around here. And to what degree does this terribly humiliating sexual imagery, which is an abuse by in any society, but particularly for the Arab male, this would be breaking, the goal is to break down all defenses. And these are the kinds of traumatic events that can leave scars for a lifetime.
Does torture work? Does it usually yield useful information?
Well, the answer to that is yes and no. Yes, it can certainly, any one of us fairly quickly could have our defenses broken down. But as has been said by a number of people who have been in these situations, I would say anything just to end the pain or to get out of that situation. So the question of the reliability of the information is quite murky. Are there situations where it would seem, if we could only get this information out of this potential terrorist who has knowledge of this, we could potentially save the lives of 50 people or 100 people? Doesn't that justify this? When we go over that slippery slope, go over that edge, we become a terrorist state.
Dr. Post, thank you.
My great pleasure.
Dr. Gerald Post is director of the Political Psychology Program at George Washington University and author of the new book, Leaders and Their Followers in a Dangerous World. Just ahead, U.S. prisons beyond Abu Ghraib. And later, an audio postcard from Athens. The Olympic Committee says the city will be ready for the August Games as Athenians work around the clock.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The focus has been on Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad, but the United States is holding prisoners, thousands of them, around the world. Dana Priest, Washington Post staff writer, has been writing about them, the conditions in U.S. prisons and jails, the legal framework underpinning the detentions, and the interrogation techniques those prisoners are facing. And Dana joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Dana, do we know even approximately how many prisoners the U.S. is holding in detention centers and these interrogation facilities around the world?
Well, we really only know about the military numbers, and that's not because they've come out and laid it all out for us, but you piece it together between human rights reports and some of the things the Pentagon has said recently. We calculate that there are about 9,000 people, the vast majority held in military prisons and jails, and even holding cells in Afghanistan and Iraq. But then there is a whole other category of people who are being detained by foreign governments at the request of the United States. We have no idea how many they are. And then the last category are people that are detained by the CIA in CIA interrogation centers. And really, that's probably just 2 to 3 dozen people, and no one talks much about them at all.
Well, as you say, we do know about prisoners being held in Iraq, Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay. But these other countries, are these the prisoners or detainees who have been rendered? That's the word that we're hearing.
In the category of people held by foreign governments at the request of the United States, yes, that's called rendering. And in those cases, the real rendering goes on when someone from Egypt may be in another country, Yemen, and the United States or the Yemenis would help pick them up, and then the CIA would actually fly them to Egypt. And then, depending on the individual, depending on the country, the CIA would oversee or supervise or in some way participate in interrogations.
And you quote a former CIA officer as saying that there's a long history of this, it's been done for decades, and it's absolutely legal?
Well, it's legal under a presidential finding. So in that sense, the president, both President Clinton and President Bush, used this mechanism. It was a covert finding and a directive which permitted the CIA to do this sort of thing and permits Congress to fund them to do this. It started actually as a drug issue. They picked up Colombian drug lords and often would actually bring them back to the United States. So it was a way of an extrajudicial kidnapping, if you will, and the use of that tactic in counterterrorism operations is definitely increased, and they describe it openly as one of their key tactics.
Dan, and we've seen some pictures, obviously, from Abu Ghraib. Could you paint a picture for us of some of these other holding centers, some of which we understand are as small as shipping containers? What does it look and feel like in these other detention centers around the world where thousands of detainees are?
I am told that there is or was a shipping container that would be, you know, like a railway car almost, the big sort of portable shipping containers that large numbers of cars can fit in even. The military uses those for temporary headquarters and buildings when they go into the field. And what I was told was that one of those is used in a very segregated part of Bagram by the CIA to interrogate CIA prisoners. Those would be the people that they suspected of having links to al-Qaeda, and that's very much off-limits even to the military personnel there.
But still, do you have a sense of what kind of interrogation techniques are used?
We only have a general sense, and that is that this idea of stress and duress techniques are used. We have a pretty good idea that people are roughed up and disoriented by troops that capture them often, not only the hooding, but there are constant stories of people being beat up or people being forced into isolation and to stand for long hours before they even get into the system of interrogation. Once they're there, there is an interrogation rules of engagement that's been signed off at the highest levels for the CIA. We don't have a good visibility into what that is. All I know about it is that when you really want to ratchet up the pressure, you do need to seek higher approval, and sometimes that approval goes all the way up to the president.
Well, what's your sense then? We heard hearings all day yesterday trying to get at the bottom of whether or not this was policy, systemic, a group of soldiers acting on their own. What's your sense of how widespread the techniques that we saw used at Abu Ghraib are in these hundreds of other holding facilities?
Well, the techniques we saw in photographs, there's no way to know, and my sense is that they were an extreme. But what you find when you look at the human rights community that has been interviewing people in Afghanistan in particular, but also in Iraq, and you pair that together with the outlines of an increased harshness in permitted rules of engagement, what the picture that you have is that particularly in Guantanamo and Afghanistan, and then later among a certain population in Iraq, the U.S. military and the CIA were given permission to use techniques that would bring physical and mental pain to detainees.
Well, Danny, you've been covering America's military for a long time. As these pictures came out from Abu Ghraib prison, what was your reaction?
Well, sadness and, you know,
But surprise?
I was surprised at the gross imagination and the use of sexual humiliation. But I do think that some of those guards were, this is not an excuse, it is a way to understand the world they were operating in. Some of those guards believed that they were supposed to apply pressure, and they were in the midst of a violent counterinsurgency that had killed Americans. When you put those two together, you can understand, but not condone, but you can understand how people go off the deep end.
Washington Post staff writer Dana Priest. Dana, thank you.
Thank you.
Dana is also the author of The Mission, Waging War and Keeping Peace with America's Military. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we speak to a high school friend of Nick Berg, the young man killed in Iraq this week. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
The price of crude oil has reached its highest level in 13 years to $40 a barrel, which means, you guessed it, higher prices at the pump. Joining us on the line is Amy Jaffe, an energy fellow at Rice University in Texas. And Amy, help us out here. Is this the usual summertime story of warmer weather equals higher prices, or is something else going on here?
Well, I think we have to set our eyes to the Middle East to understand why oil prices are so high. We do typically get a slight bump up in prices for gasoline this time of year. It's our so-called motoring holiday. Weekend is just around the corner with Memorial Day, and then after that, 4th of July. But we have had these attacks on energy facilities in Saudi Arabia. There's concerns about a rise in terrorism inside Saudi Arabia. We had the sabotage attack on the Iraqi pipeline, which has curtailed exports from Iraq. And whenever the Middle East looks unstable, the crude oil market goes up. And when the crude oil market goes up, U.S. gasoline prices go up with it.
What's this going to mean for airline tickets now that the summer travel season is upon us?
Well, you know, I think we're going to get a hit in the pocketbook all around. We are seeing both an increase in travel abroad by Americans, and so we're seeing the planes, more planes being pulled out to service a greater number of routes, and the price of jet fuel is also rising as a result of that and also as a result of the sort of backdrop of higher crude oil prices. So there has been discussion of are seeing suddenly on top of our tickets, say, some kind of fuel surcharge, or we may just see it in a slightly higher cost to go from point A to point B. But I think the American consumer can assume that summer travel will be more expensive this year, whether they're doing it by car or by plane, than it was the last 2 years, as we see sort of an increase in demand combined with the instability in the Middle East.
Well, come the fall, any prospect for these prices going back down?
Well, I think that the emerging signs from OPEC that even they feel that maybe they were too quick to cut production and, quote-unquote, get themselves higher oil prices. I'm hoping that we will see a decision, which has been hinted at, that OPEC will put some more oil on the market. and price definitely affects demand. And I think that with these high prices, people will be a little bit more thoughtful about their energy choices. And I think we'll see that demand won't keep growing at the high pace it's grown over the last year.
Thanks, Amy.
All right, very good.
Amy Jaffe is the Wallace Wilson Fellow for Energy Studies at the James Baker Institute at Rice University.
Athens is under construction. Workers can be seen across the city, but today, following its final inspection before August, the International Olympic Committee announced that, despite earlier concerns, Athens, Greece, would be ready to hold the Olympics.
It is going to be okay on time.
But will it be secure? When we visited Athens last week, three bombs exploded at a local police station and reverberated around the world. But most of Athens shrugged. People told us it was domestic criminals, and they didn't seem at all concerned about Islamic militant violence.
How did you feel about yesterday's bombings?
The Muslims, they are friendly with Greek people. So I don't think we're going to have problems like that.
It was an isolated incident. It has nothing to do with prepare or the Olympic Games. And it was a terrorist group, maybe it was a terrorist group, from the inside.
Still, it was surprising to find an unlocked, unguarded gate at the base of the Acropolis. We found the correct entrance, along with tourists from around the world, and made our way up to the Parthenon, which has weathered assaults both natural and man-made since 432 BC. But should someone have searched our bags?
Were you surprised at the lack of security here at the Parthenon and the Acropolis?
Yeah, actually. There's only a couple people dressed in civilian clothes staying around, but it's like we could have got in through the back coming into the park here, so... Yeah. On the streets, like around Syntagma Square and places like that, there seems to be a lot more security.
And you're from where?
From Canada.
How about the new Olympic Stadium? It's crosstown. Have you seen that yet?
Yes, I have. Just yesterday. And it's not quite complete yet.
How does it look?
It's almost there. It's actually quite impressive. It's quite a series of arches. And the building is architecturally very beautiful, but just there's a lot of construction still going on.
I heard they have to put 75,000 seats in. Do you think they're going to finish it in time?
I hope so.
Well, we drove out to the stadium. In fact, we drove right into the Olympic Village venue, past a security booth with a waving guard. From the main road running alongside, you can see workers on steel beams high in the air like ants scrambling over almost a mile of extraordinary architecture. Two huge arcs rise over the stadium, waiting to embrace the 18,000-ton rotating roof, an engineering marvel if it can be finished in time, which most Athenians said would happen.
100%.
What makes you
Why?
Think so?
Because the Greeks, all the time, they work very good at the last moment.
I was on a plane with a woman from Athens who said that she was worried and her friends were worried they weren't getting on trains anymore because they were worried that Athens would be another Madrid.
No. It's so obvious, like a target. Nobody was expecting to have that, what happened in Madrid. After Spain, we are more afraid, but not so much, because we believe that if we talk for terrorism, we make them more powerful. And Greeks had spent $800 million for the security. So we believe that it's going to be good and safe.
Will Athens be ready for the Olympics?
For sure. You have to be sure for that.
You have faith you'll be ready.
Yeah, we are going to be ready and we are going to make the best Olympic ever games. Postolene, Nico.
The Olympic Games that will happen in Athens will be the best that ever happened. Maybe in Greece we do things, you know, kind of late, but I'm sure, I'm positive that we'll be ready. Everything is going to be ready.
Voices from Athens last week. This week, Greek engineers began moving the huge arcs at the Olympic Stadium along especially constructed tracks. And tomorrow, Greek police and military, with the help of a seven-nation advisory force, will begin a four-day terrorism drill as Greece continues to get ready for the August Games. Still to come, the future of theater and more when we talk with director and playwright Robert Brustein. You're listening to Here and Now. If you happen to find yourself elected president, you might have a few questions, such as, are there any snacks? How do I tie a bow tie? And just exactly who is the White House usher? Well, you'd better bring along a copy of a new book. It's called How to Be President, and author Stephen P. Williams joins us on the line. Welcome, Stephen.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. Well, you know, some places it's hard to tell your goal here. For instance, there's a section on how to do the box step for presidential dinners. It's complete with diagrams with the cutouts of feet.
Yes.
But it seems as if you took this whole thing kind of seriously.
Well, it's definitely a serious book, but it's about the presidential lifestyle rather than the presidential work in running the country and managing the world.
And tell us some of the things you thought needed to be included.
Well, definitely the most surprising thing for me was that the president and every refrigerator in the White House gets free Cokes and Pepsis donated by those companies.
Not to mention M&Ms in the snack area.
Yeah, well, they also get M&Ms in a box with a presidential seal that they can give to their favorite guests.
You also include sort of diagrams of different important rooms, the Situation Room, blueprints of the family quarters and the White House. Where'd you get all of this?
This was probably the hardest part to research because I think since 9/11 this material is kept very secret. But I did a lot of very deep research in the Library of Congress and different institutions to come up with maps. And various books published before 9/11 have maps.
Well, some would say it should be kept secret. I mean, do you have any qualms about that?
Well, the maps aren't so detailed that I think it could cause anyone any problem. I definitely, in this book, took care not to reveal any information that I thought would be harmful.
Yeah. It reads as sort of a how-to or a travel guide. Here's a little information on how to remember people's names. You say the president might want to, you know, say, it's great to meet you, Julia, and repeat the name as they hear it.
Well, think about how many people they have to meet, and every person who meets the president wants to be remembered, so it's pretty important.
This is the kind of book that some people might say you sat around with friends after having, you know, exotic mixed drinks and thought, what would we want our president to know for his lifestyle? Why did you come up with it?
Well, truthfully, when I was a kid growing up in Kansas, I was always told that I could be president. And I'm not president yet. I'm 46 years old, but I thought I'd write the manual and see what to do when I got the job.
Just in case.
Yeah.
Tick off some of the other things that you thought should be included. I'm on page 54, how to read the insignias of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And there's a diagram.
Yeah, I thought that was really helpful because I don't think the president goes into the job actually knowing what they're going to have to do. And, for instance, I don't think they know how to navigate Air Force One, how the helicopters work, where the headphones on the helicopter, where to go on vacation. I think all that's very important.
Where to get stamps and cash. Turns out it's in the basement of the White House. How to pick out a new chair, a new rug.
Right.
Secret passageways?
Yes, there are. The chief usher of the White House, who basically runs the White House, claims that there are no secret passageways. But I found many references, including one with an entrance called the Maryland entrance,
which is in the basement, again, of the White House. Mm-hmm. By the way, we should point out you're a journalist, a longtime freelance news writer, and also a fiction writer.
Yes.
That probably helped you in the section on press conferences.
Yes, I was able to call friends who've worked in the White House and check on that. And also, the section I was most prepared for was how to evade reporters' questions, because I've faced that all my life.
Right, and you had some very good solutions there in the book. Stephen, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Stephen P. Williams, author of the new book, How to Be President. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Robert Brustein is perhaps best known as the founding director of the Yale Repertory in New Haven, Connecticut, and the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He has dedicated much of his life to championing the importance of art and culture in American society through books, lectures, and hundreds of often controversial articles. Throughout his long career, Brustein has overseen more than 200 theatrical productions as director or producer, and now he's in the process of massaging his own work in progress. It's called Spring Forward, Fall Back. And while it's not the first play that Brustein has written, it may be his most personal. Here and Now's Bill Delaney recently sat down with Robert Brustein to talk about Spring Forward, Fall Back, and to take the pulse of American theater.
Welcome, Mr. Brustein.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Let's talk just for a moment about Spring Forward, Fall Back. It has premiered as a work in progress, four major scenes at the American Repertory Theater. It's about a Jewish family's journey from World War II right through 9/11. How autobiographical is this play?
I wouldn't say it's autobiographical. It springs from biography, but a lot of fiction in it as well.
You have deep roots in theater themed with Jewish themes. You even played in Yiddish theater when you were a young man.
I played in English in Yiddish theater, actually, yes. But I was fascinated by the process there. And also about the family relations, how there's always that marvelous scene between fathers and their children when they're alienated from each other, and then there's this marvelous moment when they reconcile and grope each other, kissing each other, hugging each other, and crying. Father, you know, Papa. So in a way, that kind of underlies this play as well.
You've had such a public career. At this point in your life, why are you writing a story about fathers and sons and mothers and daughters that brings us, as I say, right up from the Artie Shaw era, as is pointed out in the play, right through the Grateful Dead era?
Well, I wanted to show how conflicts between parents and children over music really reflects deeper conflicts, political conflicts, cultural conflicts, even religious conflicts. And I wanted to show that in three generations of fathers and sons.
Let's talk just for a moment, because the play does address the impact of 9/11 to an extent. As you survey the artistic landscape right now, are you surprised that there hasn't been more confrontation with 9/11 at this point, three-some-odd years afterward in art?
I think in many ways that the drama of our time is deeply influenced by 9/11, whether it's explicit or not. And there is one particular play that I'm quite fond of called Omnium Gatherum, which is about a dinner party from hell, which in effect is right on the money with 9/11. It's kind of a Shavian disquisitory play about the representing the various points of view of controversialists in relationship to this catastrophe. So I think playwrights are grappling with it, but it may be too close and too traumatic an event, really, for people to get a true handle on at the moment.
Robert Brustein, through your career, you've never shied from having a political content to your involvement in the public arena. How do you feel about this political moment in relation to the arts under this White House administration?
Well, this White House administration clearly has no interest whatsoever in the arts, except possibly as instruments of propaganda for the Iraqi war. I've never really experienced a political administration that's been as thuggish as this one. You want me to get into this issue? I mean, we're really, I think, in the hands of the bullies in the schoolyard. They've taken over the school. And they were never very interested in the arts, those bullies, and they never will be.
The bullies in the schoolyard. How much does that affect artists, though? I mean, what's the impact on artists who sit in rooms and create?
Well, the bullies used to beat up the artists. They were the kids with the glasses. So they do affect them. And insofar as the government used to help artists through the subsidies of the National Endowment for the Arts, they were of great help to American artists. And as you know, that agency it's not kaput, but it's virtually useless except as a kind of historical commission now.
This whole question of what theater should be in a in contemporary times. It's something that you've dealt with throughout your career. You know, I was looking back at some pieces about you, and it was bringing me back to an ongoing debate, I guess we could call it, in the 90s that you had with the great African-American playwright August Wilson. And I found a quote from you. You said, "Theater works best as a unifying rather than a segregating medium." You had questioned Wilson's insistence that black theater needed to be unique and distinct like the black experience. And now you've written this play steeped in Judaism as a cultural experience. Are you, so to speak, segregating out an audience that may not resonate with a play so centered on a Jewish family's journey?
My son actually says, "Watch out, you're becoming the Jewish August Wilson." But no, I see, my objection—
Not necessarily a bad thing.
Oh, well, that's a very flattering thing to say. But, you know, my objections to August's statements were not that he was dealing with a black experience. I think he had to deal with a black experience, but rather that he was saying that no blacks should be allowed to act in plays by white people. I thought that was a segregating idea, and I happen to believe that blacks should act in any plays they want to, and they should play Hamlet or King Lear or Othello or whatever role they want. And he was saying, no, that was in a way embracing the slaveholder. And that's where our major quarrel was.
What do you think is particularly distinctive and important that's happening in the American theater right now? Or are you worried about the state of American theater right now?
I think it's appropriate always to worry about the state of the theater. I mean, you know, we always worry about whether the theater is going to live or die. It's in a song by Simon and Garfunkel. Is the theater really dead? You know, that's 20, 30 years ago.
Right.
But I think we are having troubles at the moment because the audience is graying. The ticket prices are going up to a point where young people cannot afford them.
You sure are.
The excitement of the movies, and they really, you know, it really is an exciting medium, seems to be distracting people from live theater. I don't think theater will ever die because it's almost cliche to say it's one of the last places where you can commune and connect with other human beings. When I sit in the movie theater, I don't want to sit next to anyone else. I want to be alone with my fantasies and watch this pre-cooked, you know, thing. It's all not done before me. It's been done some time in the past. Now I'm looking at the results. When I go to the theater, if I'm not sitting next to somebody, I think there's something wrong with the play. And it's very good to rise up with other people and respond to the play, mm-hmm. and also to get out in the street and get away from the entertainment centers that we're all building into our houses like moles. You know, we've got to go and live in the streets more than we do.
You know, as someone who every young playwright would want to be admired by, I'm curious if you could name just one or two young playwrights who you like, who our listeners might not be aware of.
Well, there's young Adam Rapp, who we've done three plays of his at the ART now. I think he's a very exciting young playwright. Neil LaBute is doing some very interesting work. Kenneth Lonergan, who is now writing for film, but he wrote a wonderful play called This Is Our Youth, and I think he's one of the more exciting playwrights we have around today.
You know, you mentioned Kenneth Lonergan, who's now doing more cinema. What brings a young, gifted writer of dialogue, of scenes, to the theater, do you think, as opposed to going Hollywood, where potentially the money is so much more spectacular and the glory and the fame even?
Well, there's an old Polish joke about Hollywood, that which is that the Polish actress slept with a screenwriter. in other words, you don't get anywhere by sleeping with a screenwriter. Right. You have to sleep with a director. Whereas in the theater, the playwright really is preeminent. And if you want to be able to control what you've written, you better stay in the theater. If you want to simply be a figurehead or an instrument in somebody else's vision, you go to the movies.
Robert Brustein, thank you very much for coming in.
And thank you very much.
Robert Brustein is founding director and creative consultant of the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and author of The Work in Progress, Spring Forward, Fall Back.
Yes, we speak of things that matter with words that must be said. Can analysis be worthwhile? Is the theater really dead?
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.